This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 12th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for being with us today. And we begin with a White House in crisis. After a year of denying that his campaign had any connection to Russians or the Russian government.
It's just a total deflection, this whole thing with Russia. I never met Putin. I don't know who Putin is.
After calling the idea of Russian meddling in the 2016 election fake news.
This Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
And after essentially dismissing the conclusions of the American intelligence agencies.
I think it could very well have been Russia, but I think it could well have been other countries, and I won't be specific, but I think a lot of people interfere. I think it's been happening for a long time.
President Donald Trump is facing the first smoking gun evidence that key members of his campaign knowingly met with Russians in order to obtain information that they were told were part of a Russian government effort to help Donald Trump. Yesterday, the New York Times was ready to publish emails showing exactly that, until Donald Trump Jr. preempted the paper by tweeting them out himself. In June of last year, publicist Rob Goldstone wrote to Donald Trump Jr. to set up a meeting with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya. Goldstone said there would be information damaging to Hillary Clinton, that the information was very high level and sensitive, and that it is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. Donald Jr.'s response, "If it's what you say, I love it." And the meeting was arranged. Donald Trump Jr. now says he's prepared to cooperate and testify in front of congressional intelligence committees investigating Russian meddling and now what appears to be possible Russian coordination in the 2016 election. If he does, Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden will be there. He's a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he joins me now. Senator, welcome.
Todd, thanks for having me.
Senator, is what I just described and what America has seen over the last 24 to 36 hours direct evidence of coordination or collusion with Russia?
Well, I said yesterday that I think based on Donald Trump Jr.'s words, his own words, this was an attempt at collusion. Let's talk about what happened yesterday, because what happened yesterday was particularly powerful. Based on the emails that Donald Trump Jr. released, the highest levels of the Trump campaign walked, eyes open, into a meeting designed to advance the Russian government's support for Donald Trump. So those emails show that there's no longer a question of whether this campaign sought to collude with a hostile foreign power to subvert the American democracy. The question is how far the coordination goes.
Natalia Veselnitskaya, Senator, says she has no connections to the Russian government. You can believe her or not believe her, but given the information in the emails that you described from Donald Trump Jr. himself, does that even matter at this point, whether she admits to being connected to the Russian government or not?
Well, first of all, it's clear that there is a significant amount of public commentary indicating that this person was a trusted insider in Moscow. But what we have to do now is talk to all of the parties, get the facts, and elected officials, given what happened yesterday, have to stand up, do their duty, and that's to protect and defend the Constitution.
And you released that statement yesterday. It's up to both parties to protect and defend the Constitution. Some people took that to be an endorsement or a whisper for impeachment, Senator.
First of all, impeachment starts in the House of Representatives. The Senate has a very different kind of function. We're really the jurors in these kinds of matters. What I've tried to say is that I hope that we're done with the days when senators and folks are talking about there being no evidence of collusion. There is evidence now. And people can try to justify the meeting and the intent of what they believe the Trump campaign had going in. But you can't pretend that this, A, isn't serious and that there's no evidence of collusion.
Many shoes, Senator Wyden, as you know, have dropped throughout this episode and throughout the time since President Trump took office. Many of your Republican colleagues, as shoes drop, have said they're frustrated or troubled by the developments. Few of them have moved to do anything about it. Have you sensed any change in attitude since yesterday, substantially, certainly, among your Republican colleagues?
Certainly, if you listen to Senate Republicans on the floor in the cloakrooms where we get together for short meetings, certainly their support level, just in terms of the tone and the volume, has been much more muted, yes. I mean, I think that the real question, though, is are they willing to do more to make sure that we get the facts and that they stand up and protect our unique system of government, protect and defend the Constitution? And that means asking the hard questions in the public, you know, public hearings, and getting the facts. It's one thing to be more muted in your support, you know, publicly. It's another thing to say, this is now extraordinarily serious business, and we are going to stop buying, you know, the idea that they have been offering up, that there is no evidence of collusion. I have heard that again and again and again, and that's clearly not accurate anymore.
Well, to that end, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, Donald Trump Jr. says he's willing to testify in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I want to talk to you about that in one second, but let me play you the words of Donald Trump Jr. himself. This comes from the Hannity Show on Fox News on the question of whether the president knew about this knowing coordination by his son and other members of the Trump campaign.
Did you tell your father anything about this?
No. It was such a nothing. There was nothing to tell. I mean, I wouldn't have even remembered it until you start scouring through the stuff. It was literally just a wasted 20 minutes, which was a shame.
Senator, do you believe him?
Let me kind of walk through kind of what's happened, then we'll talk about this matter of whether the president knew. We are going on what amounts to the fourth version of the story here. The first time it was about adoption. And then it was, well, there was a Russian person, but we didn't know much about what was going on. And then the New York Times came out with a story that indicated, well, they seemed to really know going in what was going on. And then yesterday we got the new emails, which said that there was an email, and Donald Trump Jr. said, hey, you want to hand me dirt on Hillary Clinton? I love it. His words, not mine. I love it. So there are now four versions of the story, if you count last night's, which was that he said, well, I should have probably handled it differently. So let's now talk about the matter of the president. We know that Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort were copied on the emails and that they attended the meeting. So you have to say, is it plausible that the president's son, his son-in-law, and his campaign manager met with the goal of colluding with Russia, and candidate Donald J. Trump never learned about it? We'll have to answer that question.
You sound like you think that's implausible.
I'm just going to leave it at that. I mean, you know, part of my job, my dad was a journalist, and my dad said, Ron Boy, it's your job up there to ask the hard questions. It took me 6 months to prepare to ask that question to James Clapper, whether the government collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. It took me 6 months to prepare that question. He lied. He lied to the Congress. He lied to the American people. And what James Clapper said changed the surveillance debate. We got a law passed to reform it.
So, Senator, let's talk about the Intelligence Committee where you sit that's been conducting this investigation, both in open public hearings and in closed classified hearings. Donald Trump Jr., as I mentioned, said he's happy to testify. Hopefully he'll do that in public. I guess your chairman, Richard Burr of North Carolina, will decide when and where that happens. But let's step back for this for a couple of seconds, because the committee's been following several threads. Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, and his meetings with Russians and the circumstances of his firing and his business ties. Paul Manafort, the former campaign manager, now Donald Trump Jr., and what he knew about the people he was meeting with along with Manafort, and also Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, his meetings with Russians, and possible business dealings with sanctioned Russian banks. So we're talking about this latest shoe that has dropped in the last 36 hours. Where does it fit for you in the big picture?
Well, let's talk about the emails that came out yesterday, and then we'll talk about the matter of the committee's investigation. And as I've said, our committee has a different function than Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller has a job on the criminal side to determine if there are criminal violations. It is our job on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to tell the American people what happened to our democracy and to do it in a way that doesn't compromise what are called sources and methods or classified, you know, matters. Now, to me, when you read the emails of yesterday, you get a lot of additional questions. The email to Don Jr. said that the dirt on Hillary Clinton was, and I quote here, part of Russia and its government's support for Trump. So you ask yourself, what else was part of that support? Did the campaign know about Russia's hacks? So those would be some of the additional questions that are just on my mind, having been through the emails now.
Sure. Well, Senator, let me just ask you because I don't want to lose you, but you don't discuss classified briefings or the closed briefings that you get on the Intelligence Committee. But are we likely to find out more along the lines of this revelation concerning Donald Trump Jr. that we read about?
I'm not going to speculate on that. We've got a lot of work to do. My job is to share no secrets, break no oaths, ask tough questions, and I'm going to do it.
Last question before we let you go, Senator Wyden. Jared Kushner, one of the aspects of this is whether he was truthful and complete on his security clearance forms about his meetings with Russia. He's already had to update some of those. Do you think that Jared Kushner now can plausibly say that this was an innocent oversight, that he didn't know that he was meeting with Russians in June?
I don't ascribe a lot of motivations in this kind of situation, but I think he's going to have a heavy lift to make the case on that point.
Donald Trump Jr. says he's willing to testify in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee about meeting with Russians and being told that that meeting was part of a Russian effort to aid his father in the 2016 campaign. Ron Wyden is a Democratic senator from Oregon who sits on that Intelligence Committee. Senator, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And let's stay in the Senate now, where Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is working double duty. He's struggling to prevent the president's deepening scandal from overtaking the Republican agenda. Meanwhile, he's also struggling to prevent that agenda from falling of its own weight. The Senate is back from its July 4th recess. Republicans left town without being able to pass their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. And the vacation did not help matters. As senators went home to their states, more of them came out against the plan. Well, if one vacation did not help the bill's chances at the hands of angry constituents, two vacations certainly will not help. McConnell announced yesterday that the traditional August recess will start 2 weeks late because he's determined to get 50 Senate Republicans on board with their central promise to voters for the past 7 years.
We'll be on health care next week. We'll be laying out a revised version of the repeal and replace effort, the text of that. On Thursday morning, we hope to have a CBO score by the beginning of the week and a motion to proceed to that bill next week.
Now, some of McConnell's Republican senators have already said the bill is as good as dead. As you heard there, Mitch McConnell, though, is not giving up. Perry Bacon Jr. is a senior writer with 538, and he's with me now. Hi, Perry.
Todd, thanks for having me.
They're back from July 4th. As I mentioned, just how many votes shy is Mitch McConnell now?
You know, by my count, there's 9 members who've come out pretty strongly against this bill so far. You have to have 50 for the bill to pass, so they probably need 7 more votes than what they have now. So that's a pretty substantial deficit to start from.
There's been this wide gulf that we've talked about. Several conservatives who say it's not a true Obamacare repeal. It leaves insurance subsidies in place, doesn't do enough to repeal the Medicaid expansion. On the other side, several moderate senators saying Medicaid is critical to their states. Those divisions only seem to have deepened over the break. If there's a revised version, how does McConnell bring it together?
Yeah, the break was important because I think you had 4 or 5 senators, Susan Collins of Maine, Dean Heller of Nevada being the leading ones, who were saying the bill was too conservative. And then you had Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, kind of the leaders in saying the bill was not conservative enough. But you had over the break, you had a couple outliers. I'd name Kansas's Jerry Moran being the sort of most significant, who also came out, who were sort of new to this and said, hey, these Medicaid cuts are too deep for rural areas. Moran's not really known as a moderate or not really known at all for someone who kind of doesn't vote with the rest of the party. So that was surprising to me. So what it sounds like the outlines of what they're going to do are, is they're going to keep some of the tax increases that were in Obamacare and use some of that money to increase the subsidies from where the bill was when the CBO last reviewed it, because some of the CBO scores were, you know, suggested if you were older, particularly there were, you're going to have, I mean, very, very high costs and premiums, much more than before. But my understanding so far is McConnell is not going to probably change those Medicaid cuts very much. So that's going to be a big challenge. That's where we're probably losing 4 or 5 Republicans is purely on those Medicaid cuts.
So keeping tax increases on wealthy people that are in Obamacare so that you have billions more to pay for premiums and subsidies for folks with insurance is not a great way to get the Ted Cruz's and the Rand Paul's and the conservatives of the world on board with your bill. I mean, that sounds like more Obamacare, not less.
Right. So there's some debate about what exactly the Cruises and the Mike Lee of Utah, Rand Paul, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, that conservative, and what they want. You know, they've been pushing for this kind of what they're calling the Cruz Amendment, which would essentially change the insurance rules and allow, if as long as an insurer sold plans that were kind of Obamacare compliant, they could also sell plans that were not Obamacare compliant under current law. Plans that were maybe had less coverage, didn't cover maternity, didn't cover a lot of essential benefits. So the challenge with that is people worry that creates sort of one market for the healthy and one market for the sick, and that'll drive up costs a lot. So in terms of politics, though, it's not clear if they're going to include that amendment in the bill. And the reason is because you've had several moderate members say, we don't like that idea and we don't want that amendment in there. So one of the core questions is, can you add in things the conservatives like that the moderates will vote for too? And I think they're trying to work on language that appeals to both. And that's going to be very challenging, I think.
So, Perry, Mitch McConnell has canceled part of the August recess. Clearly, this is mission critical for him. Talk about the political risk here of getting through the summer, getting to Labor Day without success on repealing and replacing Obamacare while the Russia investigation hangs over all of this.
You know, I think there are 2 political risks. I think one is, if you look at the base of the Republican Party, the activists, the people who give money, the people who are energized by the party, who do a lot of the work for it, I think they're going to be irritated if you don't end up with Obamacare repeal because the party has promised that. On the other hand, you've seen the polling about this actual legislation. We're talking about 12%, 17%. By some measures, you know, the 538's done, this is one of the most unpopular major bills we've had in 20 to 30 years. So if you're Dean Heller in Nevada and you are trying to run for re-election next year, your politics suggests you should vote against this, and it's not going to help you. So I think the politics are very different depending on, and I think the states like in West Virginia, or if you're a senator from Ohio, the states that have expanded Medicaid, the you know, people in those states are very nervous about this bill and the Medicaid cut. So I think the politics depend on where you are. Like, I understand for Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, there's a big incentive to pass this bill. For Donald Trump, there probably is a big incentive to pass this bill. I would argue for the individual members, there's not as much incentive, and that's part of the problem here.
Perry Bacon Jr., senior writer with 538. Thanks, Perry.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me.
And now, a milestone in physics. A team of Chinese researchers has achieved a form of teleportation in space. Now, you're thinking exactly what I'm thinking. But no, this isn't exactly beam me up, Scotty. This is quantum teleportation. It involves the strange and complex properties of photons, light particles. Scientists routinely teleport photons here on Earth, but in space, this is an impressive new achievement. Krista Schalm is a research associate at the National Institutes of Standards and Technologies, and he's here to explain what all this means. Krista, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I used the word teleportation. Am I exactly right?
Yes, you are exactly right. You mentioned that people often think about teleportation. They think about Star Trek. And, you know, you step onto the teleporter pad and then you appear at some distant location. And we have to do a form of that in the quantum world. So I'm a quantum physicist. And what that means is I study the properties or the behavior of some of the smallest things in the universe, things like atoms and little particles of light, photons. And one of the interesting things you learn about quantum mechanics are the rules are quite a bit different than what we would normally experience in our everyday lives. The physics is different. And there's this one property of these quantum particles, and that is that you can't make a copy of them. So instead, what we have to do is we have to teleport these properties in order to move information around. And that's exactly what this Chinese group has done. They have teleported the properties of a photon on Earth and transferred it to another photon that they've then sent to the satellite that's whizzing above them in space.
So that's really amazing. But if we ever achieve the sci-fi fantasy of teleporting objects, will this be the day that the history books, or probably the history goggles in the future, point to as the first successful attempt at the kind of teleportation we've always dreamed of?
I think if you want to get to the point of teleporting, you know, humans or objects, we're really far away. I mean, it's a long way to go from a single particle of light to, say, thinking about all the complexities involved with, you know, even the simplest of objects. But it turns out that if you want to build a computer or a kind of network that uses the laws of quantum mechanics, which would allow you to build a more powerful computer for solving certain types of problems, it turns out quantum teleportation is one of the fundamental building blocks. And so I think when we look back at the history of, you know, building this new type of computer, this will be seen as a landmark. This is something that people have been trying to do for a very long time. And so what these guys have done is truly heroic, trying to put all the apparatus for actually sending this very fragile quantum information and actually, you know, linking it between the Earth and a satellite moving above in space.
So this may be the future of super powerful computers or super encrypted communication. You know that I'm a little bit focused on the teleportation idea. I mean, why not? What does it take to scale this, though, for the sci-fi fantasy? If you can entangle photons to communicate over great distances and teleport, is teleporting me, a person, just really a scale-up question of trillions of photons that are entangled in the right way?
It's even more complicated than that, because you would have to capture all of the dynamics and the interactions between. It's not just a matter of teleporting a bunch of individual particles in your body one by one, but you have to know about all the relationships for how all those things are connected together. So maybe in 500 years, people will look back and they'll have a way of moving small objects around, but I don't think that's anything on the near horizon. This is right now it's hard enough to do it just with a single particle.
So what you're saying is I should still buy my plane ticket for my vacation in August.
I think that's a wise decision.
Krista Schalm, research associate at the National Institutes of Standards and Technologies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Saudi Arabia today trying to defuse a confrontation between the Saudis, several other Gulf countries, and Qatar. The diplomatic crisis has been going on for a little over a month now. Four Arab nations that border Qatar have cut ties with that country. They're trying to force Qatar to distance itself from Iran and sever terrorist ties that its neighbors accuse it of holding. Here's Rex Tillerson.
We call on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt to ease the blockade against Qatar. There are humanitarian consequences to this blockade. We're seeing shortages of food, families are being forcibly separated, and children pulled out of school. We believe these are unintended consequences, especially during this holy month of Ramadan, but they can be addressed immediately.
That was the Secretary of State last Friday. Today, he's in the Saudi Arabian city of Jeddah holding meetings with foreign ministers from the nations boycotting Qatar. The Secretary of State is trying to work through a standoff between two sets of U.S. allies with American interests and the balance of power in the region at stake. And he's doing it while managing a boss, the president, who was tweeting a very different message than the United States is carrying now. Charles Dunn is a scholar with the Middle East Institute, and he served as a diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service for 24 years. He says this crisis could undermine U.S. counterterrorism efforts in the region.
First of all, it's having several knock-on effects that are very unhelpful to United States goals. The first of these is Gulf unity. If they're going to confront ISIS, if they're going to confront the problem of terrorism more generally, and especially if they're going to confront Iran, Gulf unity is absolutely paramount. This crisis has shattered that unity, at least for now. It's also driven Qatar into the arms of the Iranians, for whom they're now at least partially dependent on food supplies, since the Gulf states imposed embargo by land and by sea and by air. So this type of controversy is extremely unhelpful in that regard. It also prevents certain obstacles to the ability of the United States to coordinate anti-ISIS operations. The U.S. has the largest air base in the Middle East and the largest U.S. military facility in the Middle East in Qatar. That coordinates the war against ISIS, where you have the central command forward base located. And if this controversy continues, it's going to make it more difficult for the United States to coordinate these very important efforts from that location, or from anywhere else, for that matter, in the Gulf.
Charles Dunn, how much time was lost here, however? You just laid out the case why Qatar is such a critical ally. Of course, Saudi Arabia, UAE, the other countries on the other side of this dispute are important U.S. allies as well. The American administration didn't seem to know what its position was a month ago. President Trump at first praised the Saudis for isolating Qatar, then seemed to back away after learning more. Tillerson's been taking a more conciliatory stance the whole time and is now trying to solve the problem, and it seems like they lost weeks, if not a month.
I think they lost several weeks trying to get an effective mediation effort going, precisely for the reasons that you named. There was a very serious disconnect between the White House, the Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary of State. Both of the two secretaries realized what the stakes were and what they needed to do in order to calm the temperature down. And it was very difficult for them to do that when the president was tweeting in praise of the Saudi and other Gulf states' actions against Qatar, fingering Qatar as a major financier of terrorism at the highest level, I believe the president said, just days essentially after he had praised Qatar as a strategic ally in his speech in Saudi Arabia. These curveballs that kept coming out of the White House were noticed in the Gulf and were used to essentially downplay Secretary Tillerson's efforts. Some of that static seems to have gone away now, and the administration seems to be pretty much on the same page, which is why Tillerson was able to undertake his trip and can now go to Jeddah with something in hand from Qatar that he can use to try to jumpstart talks to help resolve the crisis.
So I want to drill down just for a moment more on the last several weeks, because Charles Dunn, you're describing a situation where the secretaries of defense and state of the United States had a keen sense of how critical a crisis this was between U.S. allies in a critical region. And the president of the United States did not, and essentially undermined their efforts.
Yes, that's correct. In my view, the president seems to have been pretty effectively played by the Saudi Arabian government during his trip to Riyadh, in which billions of dollars worth of arms deals, economic deals were signed. The president was feted and extolled by the Saudis as a great leader. And I think he was more than willing to go along with the Saudis' next moves, which essentially amounted to an effort to quash a long-term regional rival and clip its wings so it could no longer execute a somewhat independent foreign policy. And so I think the president's initial tweets were not helpful. And as many people have noted, it's unclear whether he understood the extent to which the United States had a military presence in Qatar that U.S. CENTCOM and other military efforts vitally depend on for the very struggle against terror that the president so badly wants to fight.
Charles Dunn, we saw a G20 summit in Europe just last week where American allies seemed to be resigned to the fact that the United States was no longer taking a leadership role in their affairs. Does the United States still have as strong a hand as it did with Saudi Arabia, with UAE, and indeed with Qatar when problems like this flare up?
I think the United States still has a very strong hand with the countries in the Arab Gulf, particularly because they are dependent on the United States for their defense against Iran, for keeping the sea lanes open, and for supplying them with arms and technology on which, as I say, they are very dependent. What's happened with U.S. leadership in the Gulf, in my opinion, over the course of the last 6 months or so, is that the Saudis in particular have concluded that the administration can be led to support their own efforts to strengthen their hegemony in the region to a much greater extent than was ever possible under the Obama and even the Bush administrations. So I think they're taking advantage of that right now. So one of Secretary Tillerson's tasks is to disabuse the Saudis and their allies of the notion that the United States is going to sit back and acquiesce in efforts to crush another United States ally and throw, you know, Gulf cooperation on security and terrorism into chaos. But that is going to take some persistent and dedicated work by the Secretary and as well as the Secretary of Defense and their respective departments.
A newly coherent foreign policy for a Middle East crisis seems to be in effect as the Secretary of State heads to Jeddah to negotiate an agreement between rival U.S. allies. Charles Dunn, a scholar with the Middle East Institute, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Love. The heart sliced open, gutted, clean. Love. Naked almost, in the everlasting street.
That's Princeton professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy K. Smith. In June, Smith was named Poet Laureate of the United States. Smith was appointed the 22nd Poet Laureate by the Librarian of Congress, and she's only required to conduct a few specific duties during the one-year job. For Smith, it's an opportunity to visit less traveled parts of the country and to use the power of her poetry to help people process some of the dissonance and anxiety Americans are facing.
One of the things we hear a lot at this moment in America is that we're a divided nation. And I feel that we're in a position of changing that. If we can stop and say, what are the voices that we've gotten used to hearing? And what are the voices that we have excluded from our consciousness? I think the voices are different depending on who's asking that question. But it excites me to think that people who may have no way of coming into direct contact with each other can find an occasion where they might have something meaningful to share with each other. And I think literature is a great vehicle for that.
You know, part of the job of Poet Laureate, at least as far as I understand it, is to look across the country, to find something about the pulse or the spirit of America, good or bad. What do you see today when you think about this country and its people in this very contentious an anxious time that you mentioned?
We're worried. We're worried about our ways of life. We're worried by all of the possibilities that are out there in a world that seems like in many ways it's beyond our control. And I feel that stepping out of our own private concerns and thinking, wow, I have these strong feelings, I have these strong perspectives, I think someone else out there is entitled to their strong feelings and perspectives too. What would it take for me to sit down and listen to those statements and wishes and think about them alongside my own? What would it make me to become a more curious, empathetic, and perhaps less apprehensive person when it comes to the other people that make up this country?
Well, there's plenty of interchange in this country, I suppose, about our anxieties and our fears of one another, our suspicions. It's all over cable news. It's all over Twitter. Is there something special about poetry that can accomplish more?
You know, poems speak to everything. Poems speak to the world. They speak to the public realm. They speak to the private. But what I think any poem, no matter the topic, does is provide a reader with a vocabulary for the inner life. It provides a sense of language, image, and even, you know, like visceral feeling that says, this is what it feels like to live in the world. This is what it feels like to live with feelings and questions and memories and wishes. And what I think that does is it pulls our attention away from all the many things in our culture that seek to convince us that we are merely parts of a powerless crowd or just a mass and indistinguishable crowd. It reminds us that, you know, we're unique, that we have agency and that we have sensitivity. And if we can believe this about ourselves, I think we're more likely to believe it about other people.
Professor Smith, you have a poem called Unrest in Baton Rouge. I wonder if you'd be willing to read it for us.
Sure. The poem is written in response to a photograph that ran. It was taken by a photojournalist named Jonathan Bachman, and it depicts an image of a woman in a sundress who is participating in a march. She's being faced by a line of police officers in combat gear. And the sense of balance or imbalance in the image, just in terms of visual weight, really spoke to my sense of the vulnerability that this woman was willing to step into. To me, the image made me think about love. And it made me think that sometimes what we're most afraid of is loving each other and thinking in compassionate rather than fearful terms about each other. So this is a poem that articulates that sense of love in a way that is a little bit dangerous. Unrest in Baton Rouge. Our bodies run with ink-dark blood. Blood pools in the pavement's seams. Is it strange to say love is a language few practice, but all or near all speak? Even the men in black armor, the ones jangling handcuffs and keys. What else are they so buffered against, if not love's blade, sizing up the heart's familiar meat? We watch and grieve. We sleep, stir, eat. Love, the heart sliced open, gutted, clean. Love, naked almost, in the everlasting street, skirt lifted by a different kind of breeze.
Tracy Smith, as you read your poem, this is the famous photo of the young black woman standing upright, as you mentioned, in the sundress, as right. Officers in riot gear approach her. She's the love in this poem.
Yeah. And I think, you know, she's beautiful and courageous, and I love that she has become an emblem of this capacity. But I also feel like it was such a powerful image because this is something that we all have the potential to manifest in one way or another. What I love about a poem's ability to speak to or process some of these really heavy issues is that unlike a dinner party, say, where you might feel emboldened to hold forth about your impassioned convictions, a poem is going to challenge you to get past what you already feel like you understand and to trouble that sense of certainty. I think a poem is also most engaging when it makes the sense of us versus them irrelevant, and where one might be made to understand that they're implicated in every aspect of a situation that might be troubling. I think that if we can't allow ourselves to be honest in that respect, then we're just kind of mouthing off.
Well, it's an exciting job you have in front of you. And maybe after you do some of that travel and some of that hearing, you might join us again at the end of your term and share some of your poems that result from that.
I'd love that.
Tracy K. Smith is professor of creative writing at Princeton University and soon to be, in September, the 22nd Poet Laureate of the United States. Well, Tracy K. Smith will begin her term as Poet Laureate in September, but we loved hearing your thoughts on this moment in American history in poet form.
My name is Alex Roederer from Plano, Texas. Russia at the gates, Trump in the water. The American people can't spare a bother. Swim to the Watergate, roll back the clocks. It's time to make America great for all the thieves and their flock.
This is Sue from Hillsborough, New Jersey. Our country has a Hoover. Not a stove or frigidaire. He makes a lot of noise and blows out stale hot air.
Hi, this is Larry Fisher from Brooklyn, New York. Here's my poem. Lunacy becomes us. A seesaw, hee-haw, nation splits. Between true believers and Adelantic dreamers, we ride a splintered carousel of conspiracy spins unparalleled. Lunacy becomes us. Don't you think?
That's Larry from Brooklyn extending a theme there. Hey, do you guys want a limerick? Because I've got one from Grand Prairie, Texas. There once was the United States where democracy made us great, but dark money and super PACs make political hacks. Now we're ruled by fake news, corruption, and hate. Give us your take or your poem, limerick form, verse, whatever you got, 8778-MY-TAKE. Or send your poetry in a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for rhyming. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.